Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, work life and technology in the data networking industry. During the week, we gather articles, ideas, and then get together to flap our chins about them. Get comfortable while we get around the workbench and diagnose the problems of the networking world with humour, wit and, just possibly, some technical talent. This week, returning for another slot around the workbench is Tom Hollingsworth. How are you this week, Tom?
Doing pretty good, Greg. I spent the week catching up on some reading and other things, trying to diagnose some of the problems that have been occurring out there in the cloud.
The cloud's had a big week, hasn't it?
It has.
And also with us this week is Brandon Carroll. How are you, Brandon? Welcome back. Tell us where you're from and where you've been.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me back. I've been good. I had a good week. You can find me at globalconfig.net, or actually I moved my blog over to brandonjcarroll.com this past week. But I spent the week out at the Rocky Mountain IPv6 Summit. Got a lot of good insight there. Had a pretty good time.
Right. So we can be arguing about the relative benefits of IPv6 then.
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, let's before we start the team meeting, though, let's just want to remind you that Packet Pushers is looking for sponsors and some donations. So I'm going to do a little bit more begging. As the show's getting bigger, it's getting harder for me to run the whole thing as a hobby in my spare time. So what I'm asking you to do to help me out is to help grow the show a little bit this week. There are two ways you could help me get the show to be a little bit larger, and one is to head on up to iTunes and leave a review. And another one is for those of you who know what StumbleUpon is, if a couple of you could link the Packet Pushers website off StumbleUpon and help expose us to some new listeners so that I can get a few more. The reason for that is as the show gets bigger, it gets easier for me to reach out to vendors and talk to them and get them to support the show financially and with more and also to provide advertising and sponsorship. I'm looking at various things around that, which would help me to spend more time on the show and less time doing freelance work, which is what I do. As always, please remember to tell people about the show when you meet them, write about it, blog about it, talk about us at conferences, hit the Facebook, the Twitter, whatever you can do it. There's a donation button, and I just want to take this opportunity to say thanks to all the people who have very generously donated. It is actually kind of special when people give you their own money, and to say thanks for what's been done. And some people have been writing some really lively things in the things, which is really inspiring. And, of course, subscribe to the mailing list at the Packet Pushers website. That's to let you know when we actually do joint promotions with the vendors. So I've been talking to vendors such as Arista about organising various events and different ideas. And if I've got mailing lists where I can talk to you, then that would be a big help to me. So let's push on with the show. I guess the first topic that we wanted to talk about today was the Amazon AWS cloudy outage. Well done, Amazon. Biggest cloud outage of the year. Got a big round of applause for them. It's been pretty funny, really, that the Amazon AWS outage has sort of shown up the fact that a lot of people have been just thumping stuff into the cloud and then sort of putting their hands over their eyes and their fingers in their ears and going, we can't see it, therefore it must be working, and have been discovered this week. And Tom, what are your thoughts on that? Have you got some views there?
Well, it cracks me up because people have been pushing cloud for so long now. I mean, it feels like years, even though it's probably really been months. And they don't realize that you still have to build redundancy into your environment, even if you're abstracting certain layers below it. I had a conversation with one of the people that worked at my office because he couldn't understand, well, if it's in the cloud, it's redundant, right? I said, not necessarily. I mean, you can make applications redundant without making the hardware underneath them redundant, you know, through use of clustering services and things like that. And I thought it was really interesting that after it was all said and done, Amazon came out with their postmortem, but they also released a new website that allows you to make, you know, plan for making your applications redundant. Kind of one of those will keep you from having to deal with this again, in just in case one of our engineers does something silly.
Just because the server's virtual doesn't mean the server's not. It's still just one server after all.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was laughing. Did you see somebody posted a link to some company put up online, and they were using an Amazon AWS instance on EC2 to monitor people's cardiac systems, so they would report some sort of server, people's cardiac monitors, had no way of collecting this data. I mean, they probably figured it'd be out for an hour or two and that'd be all right. But when it was out for days, these people's cardiac monitors weren't being monitored.
If it's mission critical, it's important enough for you to pay to make sure it never goes down. I don't know how many times we have to keep saying that over and over and over again.
The big thing is that people just expect that, you know, well, it's Amazon. It's already, it's I'm good to go, you know. Yeah, I don't have to worry about it. It's Amazon. They're big enough. You know, I'm going to pay them. They'll take care of all the redundancy. They'll take care of all the failure scenarios that could ever possibly happen. And now it's out of my head and I don't have to worry about it. But then, you know, what do we see from this? Well, you can't really trust that, can you?
Well, the trick, as I understand it, I've done some very short testing on Amazon, and there's two forms of storage in Amazon, EC2 and the S3 service. And the S3 storage service is the high availability, high reliability, you know, stuff. And the EC2 is their elastic compute storage. I think, I can't remember what it's called. I think it's EB or... it's whatever it is. It doesn't. It's not very interesting. And in this case, it was actually the EB storage or the EC storage that actually went down, which I believe is an iSCSI type environment. And that is the problem that's occurred. It's not a structural failure of the thing. It was the storage went out, and so the virtual instances couldn't spawn correctly.
Yeah, and when the storage went down, it triggered some failover capabilities inside the system that we're going to start mirroring backups and so on and so forth. And so what happened is it worked like an amplification. You had a bandwidth problem, which then tripled almost instantaneously and started dropping instances out of the cloud because there was, you know, there's no bandwidth to support it. And it, you know, it's almost like playing the game Jenga. No one particular piece could possibly cause the tower to fall, but a combination of failures all at once could very well cause it to just come crumbling down. And I think that's kind of what happened.
Yeah.
No, well, I think it's a bit more complicated. I wrote a blog post this week that complex solutions have complex failure modes. And one of the things I've discovered is as you make bigger and bigger systems with more and more complexity, it gets harder and harder to predict or design out the failures. And then when they do fail, they tend to be catastrophic in that they fail in such a way that you can't recover. And that leads me to the sort of make the point that Amazon's technology is pretty clever, and they've done a very good job of working with it and doing things with it. But it does seem to me that once it's going to fail, it's going to fail in a big catastrophic, you know, it's going to go down in a big stinking pile. A bit like, yeah, Google, you know, when they failed, they had a few months back, they had huge problems recovering from that.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense just because there's so many layers in it now that it's impossible to gracefully restart any one particular layer and expect it to have no impact on the rest of the system. You would hope that would be the case, but I guess we're seeing now that there needs to be a little bit more design work and a little more complexity diagramming, if you will, trying to figure out, you know, all the intricate moving parts in this thing.
And I see that Jeremy Gaddis over at evilrooters.com, he put out a blog post this week where he's been told from a unnamed source that the point was the network engineer was upgrading a switch somewhere in their core, and it didn't quite go very well. So he thought while he was waiting for that one to recover itself, he went off and upgraded another one. Both of them were aggregation level switches, and in the process took down the... because he shut down the entire networking connectivity, everything went dead. So must have been an entertaining thing.
Yeah, hopefully he was updating his resume shortly after that happened.
My gut feel is that he'll be looking for a job this week, yes.
If he isn't already.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah, for sure.
Well, some telco will pick him up.
He knows something. Is that what you're trying to say? You think he's worth something because at least he knows some stuff?
Sure.
Yeah.
If we just train him to upgrade iOS one router at a time, no matter how long it takes, I think we can salvage this guy.
Well, I mean, think about it, though. I mean, yeah, the guy screwed up. And
I constantly tell stories about the fact you can never count on what people are going to do when you interject, you know, living, breathing protein robots into the mix. You can never predict how they're going to do things. And it, you know, maybe Amazon completely overlooked this because they thought, well, who in their right mind would try to upgrade two aggregation switches at once? Well, that's where you have to start thinking outside the box. That's why I usually go to my wife and my five-year-old and go, all right, how would this break? Because I'm thinking about it from a technical standpoint. And they're going, well, what happened if I go pull the plug out? I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I look back when I was working at the phone company, and we had, you know, tons of guys that had access to our frame relay switches or the D-slams or, you know, things like that, but they had no privileges to anything. So it almost is like, how, if this guy had enough privileges to be able to do this, then the guy probably knew what he was doing and just screwed something up, made a mistake, right? Because big companies that have a change process in order and, you know, the process of approvals and all that kind of stuff, I mean, people that don't know what they're doing don't have access to this stuff, or they shouldn't.
Well, apparently it actually is like written in big red letters in the document, according to Jeremy, that he shouldn't have done it, but he went ahead and did it anyway. So,
Well,
maybe back when this was a lab or, you know, something that wasn't really popular, it was okay. You know, just we'll take it down for 5 minutes while we're doing this upgrade. It really won't matter. But now that it's, you know, now that it's critical for heart monitoring and, you know, like 10 different popular websites like Reddit and Foursquare, which, by the way, I heard a lot of people were real happy that it went down because their Foursquare updates and their Twitter streams just kind of evaporated overnight. And it was quiet for once.
I wasn't too bothered about the loss of a few, you know, minor startups who aren't making any money anyway. I mean, the reason they're using Amazon is to save money, and that's the price they pay. They took the risk and they take the hit. You know, nobody's been very critical. One of the interesting things, of course, is that not Google, not Rackspace, not any of the other competitors have been very quick off the mark to criticize the vendors on, you know, exactly what's been happening, which I find pretty entertaining, all things considered, because you would expect a competitor to get into play. And what that tells me is that the current cloud systems are probably not in that great a shape, and they're all sitting there going, it could happen to us very easily.
Exactly. Yeah. The first time Google comes out and says anything about this, the next time that they go down for any reason, if their Gmail goes offline for more than a couple of hours, Amazon would slam them to no end. So it's one of those deals. It's kind of like the RSA hack we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is just keeping their mouth shut so that nobody looks in their direction.
Because we might be next, because we know.
Exactly.
Yeah. The cloud systems of today are still fairly fragile, as they say. And I've seen some discussion online about this DevOps concept, which is people who are part developer and part operations, and their ability to write software which scripts changes in the system. And the developers have to be aware. It's not just adding up columns of numbers that nobody really checks. You know, this is really quite a different way of, you know, bringing together bash scripts and scripting languages on F5 load balancers and things like that. And DevOps is a new field, and then we're still finding the parameters for it. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the long term. So we've also got some more information on IPv6. So, Brandon, you were at the IPv6 conference this week.
Yeah, I was in Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, how'd that go? Was there anything of great interest there?
You know what? Yeah, it was a really good conference. But what I think I learned probably the most from it is there are just a ton of people that are still really, really green when it comes to the IPv6. And, you know, even thoughts about maybe starting a migration, starting a dual stack, you know, integration or whatever. It just seems to me that there's just tons of people. I think there's probably about 400 people there. That it was split into two sections. You had the service provider and then you had enterprise. And I think the enterprise was probably a larger base, but it seemed like service provider had a little bit more of a grip on IPv6 in general. 2 days mainly. They had the first day where it split us into tracks, and then the second day where we were all in the same room, and it was just, you know, speaker after speaker from like 8 to 5, and all kinds of different topics. Security kept coming up, and that was sort of interesting to hear some of the security stuff. I mean, that's probably take a whole nother show doing IPv6 security and talking about some of the issues that people are concerned about.
I mean,
about,
I think the IPv6 security thing's a bit overblown, because it's no different to the security problems we've got with IPv4.
Yeah, well, okay, so take for instance, one thing that I think shocked a lot of people is Ed Horley, he's at, I think it's howfunky.net.
Yeah.
You know, he was one of the speakers, and he asked how many people had Windows 7 deployed in their enterprise, and tons of people raise their hand. He says, okay, how many of you have, you know, Windows 2008 Server R2? Bunch of people raise their hand. He says, okay, how many of you have deployed IPv6? And nobody raises their hand. And he goes, okay, now everybody that raised your hand when I asked you about Windows, raise your hand again when I ask you about IPv6, because it's on by default.
That's right, yeah.
And so I think there's just so many people that don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're deploying these Windows networks that it's on by default, and now you just – the Windows firewall is not blocking the IPv6 stuff, right? So I don't think it is.
Well, it's even worse than that, of course. I mean, the simplest – the biggest security challenge you've got today is that IPv6 over IPv4 tunnels. By default, that's leaking out through your firewall. So most people are not filtering tunneling protocols going out. Well, most companies actually aren't filtering outbound. That's going to change with all of these breaches recently. The old days of being able to surf the internet without going via some sort of firewall, which is blocking protocols or inspecting stuff, is probably passing away. And IPv6 will, on Microsoft servers, will actually try and tunnel over IPv4. And so if your firewall isn't blocking that specifically, it's being leaking out to the internet using IPv6. And that's one of the security challenge, is that Microsoft made a decision to put their Teredo implementation into their clients and enable it by default, which was, you know, a good move in terms of enabling IPv6 in a way, but it actually tunnels IPv6 over IPv4. It's not IPv6 per se. And it's causing a great deal of problems with various things. We'll talk about Teredo in a little bit, perhaps, but yeah, I agree. Leakage at the moment is the bigger challenge.
Yeah, and I mean, I was at a session at Networkers, I think it was 2 years ago, over IPv6, and they were talking about how if you're not paying very careful attention at your access layer, IPv6-enabled clients can create ISOTAP tunnels all the way through the core of your network and completely disregard any kind of access list and anything you have running at the edge, and then just get access wherever they pretty much where they please. So, you know, it's being aware that you necessarily have it running in your network. You know, yeah, that Microsoft has gone to the trouble of turning it on by default almost everywhere. I'm sure Apple's done the same thing. It's understanding that it's there and that you need to plan for it. And, you know, we've been harping on the security people for the last couple of weeks, but, you know, they have to be aware that, you know, there's more to block now. It's almost back to the days where you had to worry about IPv4 and Apple Talk and IPX, SPX and all that other stuff. Well, you know, there's more than one protocol now, guys. We got to keep an eye on them all.
Yeah.
I think it comes back to the security point where in the past we've had firewalls creating a crunchy edge to your network, preventing inbound, but not enough people have actually deployed firewalls to block outbound as well and controlled outbound internet access. Like, the firewalls are there, but they've just said to let anything from the inside out because that's secure, especially in smaller companies, smaller enterprises. I was reading some documentation today, and they're saying that currently the prime target for data theft at the moment is actually hotels, because those hotels are often small businesses with very limited security. They're often internet connected. People can get access to those terminals because they're all around the hotel complex. They're not very locked down. And they actually contain people's names, addresses, credit cards. And people are mobile. They're actually a good target for stealing credit cards. They actually last quite well.
Yeah, someone was saying, I guess today, they were actually considering sniffing the GoGo in-flight Wi-Fi on a plane because it's, you know, it's behind an access device. So I'm sure there's probably all kinds of weird things you could get a hold of if you wanted to sniff that. They didn't necessarily want to do it because they were afraid the FAA was going to come find them. But, you know, it's an interesting thought.
Interesting. Security is, you know, going to be a much bigger topic in the future, but it's not going to be security like it was, say, 10 years ago, where security consultants were the only people who knew what a firewall was. It's going to be something that we all talk about and we actually deliver at every level, instead of it just being, you know, only a few people are responsible for security. It's something that we all have to be aware of every day, I believe.
Yeah, I agree.
So also this week, Jeffrey Houston, who's the man from Potteroo.net, very famous for his contributions to internet architecture and technology, published a post about Microsoft Teredo, pointed out that at the end of the day, the tunneling technologies that we have in IPv6 come down to three types: host-to-host, host-to-router, and router-to-router. So if you consider that IPv6, in terms of transition mechanisms, in term and how we get from being, you know, pure IPv4 to being pure IPv6. And long term, we talk about tunneling IPv6 over v4. We either use a GRE tunnel, which is router to router. We talk about host to router, which is ISOTAP or 6RD or one of those technologies. Or we talk about host to host, which are the three possible design options. It gets a little bit more complicated than that, but in a gross simplification, host to host is a technology where Microsoft has invented a thing called Teredo, which is their name for their own protocol. And a preliminary reading of the documentation that I gave about 2 months ago to Microsoft Teredo was that it didn't look very good. It looked a bit dodgy. And this week, Jeff Houston talks about it. And he says, effectively, what Teredo does is it uses a version of STUN. So STUN is a standard NAT traversal mechanism where a one-way firewall, you need to allow an inbound connection. You know, the host that's on the inside of the firewall punches a connection out and then allows an outside host to come back into the originating host. And Teredo uses that. But even worse is Teredo actually finds tunnel brokers. So because it's host to host, a Teredo server or a Teredo client inside your corporate network needs to reach out into the internet using IPv6. And so it needs to find a broker, a tunnel broker in the internet. And it uses anybody's tunnel brokers. So if you plugged in a 2008 server directly to the internet, it becomes an internet-wide tunnel broker for everybody. Isn't that great? Just like Skype awesome. Supernodes. So if you haven't, awesome. Yeah. So if you haven't specifically disabled Teredo on your 2008 web server, it'll become a tunnel broker. And if you've been rash enough to put it there without a firewall, it will become a GRE Teredo tunnel broker for everybody on the internet, which is pretty generous of you, really.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Which is pretty, pretty stunning, really, isn't it? You know,
it's more of that needing to know exactly what you've got in your technology before you start implementing it. Because I could see people putting these things out. Remember, used to be you put a Windows server in a DMZ to act as an RRAS point. I know there's even some technology that I was reading about in the enterprise IPv6 network where a Windows 2000 or a Windows 7 box can connect to a 2008 server. Using almost like a secure VPN connection. And so I can see some more application-oriented folks doing that and not realizing, oh, hey, by the way, you just created a Teredo supernode for everybody. It's open proxies all over again.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a good look. I was chatting with someone a few weeks back who pointed out as well that Teredo's not HA. As well. So to actually make it work in terms of reliability for an enterprise-grade network where you create IPv6 connections end-to-end, let's say you're using an internal server to form your Teredo. If that server fails, your Teredo session tears down and your connectivity is lost until a new connection is set up, which is a bit Microsoft, isn't it? It's just like Microsoft to not finish what they're doing and just say, oh, that's good enough, and then dump it out there to see if how it works. So it's
and people will just accept it because that's the way it's been done, right? We don't know any different.
Well, it's free, and there's some documentation, and they probably just implement it, and by the time you've spent 2 weeks making it work, you can't afford to go back and say, actually, I've got it wrong, and I need to do it again, which is a bit like SharePoint, really.
Article that you're talking about, the Potteru's Teredo article. I like the note about the DNS resolution. If you got an IPv6, if you actually have an IPv6 address on a host, but you don't get a DNS response back for resolution, it talks about. Even if the client has a unicast IPv6 interface, its use of IPv6 transport requires that it receive a response to a DNS query for the corresponding A record. So it's just talking about the possibility that not only the tunneling issues are there, but you also have the DNS issues that could relate to the way that traffic's being routed, being mishandled, and then possibly even having unreachable clients just because of the name resolution. It's just... what a mess.
It's pretty grim technology. And if you read the RFC on it, you'll just wish you'd killed yourself. Yeah. It's pretty grim. It's obviously that somebody who knew it, it's sort of gone along a certain path and then it's gone on to a bureaucracy and come out what is it they say? A camel is a horse designed by a committee. And that's what it looks like. It really does. You know, everybody who had an idea, they had to have their idea in the mix, and it's come out looking like it's all wrong. So it's not too great. And we also saw the release this week of some new RFCs which talk about the final, well, I think they're standards track RFC 6146 through 6147, which talk about stateful NAT 64 and DNS 64. They also talk about, there's another one I think at 6156, which is the STUN, so stateful tunneling or NAT translation for what I was just talking about before, for NAT 64 tunnels. And how, frankly, I was more than a little bit disappointed that this technology was developed. I noticed that Cisco had a big hand in making that happen. And I think a lot of people have pushed back against actually allowing NAT 64, and yet Cisco seems to have championed this process. Now, Tom, I know you're a big anti-NAT fan. You don't believe that NAT is the way forward. I suspect you'd agree with me when I say that NAT is probably
wholeheartedly.
Not the
NAT PT got wrecked.
Yep.
And I thought, great, you know, we don't have this problem anymore. And then it's, you know, it's the same people that want Sony to keep making mini disc players. I mean, do we really need these? But somebody out there thinks that we need to have it, so they're going to keep bringing it up and keep bringing it up. You know, I figured Brandon was probably at the Rocky Mountain Conference, hopefully just it's a perfect example of taking something that doesn't need to be there and just shoving it in. I mean, we could work fine without it. I could spend hours railing against the bad idea that this is going to end up being, because it's going to encourage laziness. Oh, well, you know, I don't.
Yeah, I was surprised to see the vendors, a few vendors that presented that were actually like, here's our strategy for NAT 64. And it's like, really? So you're selling equipment to help people do this. Well, that's fantastic.
For vendors, it's any port in a storm. I mean, we'll support anything you want us to support as long as you buy our box.
Yeah.
And I almost want to say, you know, as a vendor, you should take a hard line and say, I understand that you guys think this is a really cool thing, but our devices don't support it. What we support instead is proper network design from the outset.
Yeah, and it just, I mean, there's a whole bunch of standards here, and I think if you actually read the front of the IETF standard, the argument's fairly compelling, because what they're basically saying is, in the precursor here, it says...
I like how in the introduction to this one, they actually say, this is an effort to define a replacement for NAT PT, which was moved to historic status, which is basically admitting, we thought that was a bad idea, and we got rid of it, but now we need a replacement for it.
Yeah.
Mm. There's a justification down here. That's what I talked about. Oh, I remember
justification
reading
it. Or rationalization?
I was looking carefully at this other... There's a whole bunch of these IPv4, IPv6 translations, and in RFC 6144, they talk about NAT-PT was deprecated to inform the community that NAT-PT had operational issues and was not considered viable in the long term for either coexistence or transition. It wasn't intended to say that IPv4 to IPv6 translation was bad, but the way that NAT-PT did it was bad, and in particular that using NAT-PT at a general solution was bad. And then they draw an analysis here. As with the deprecation of RIP routing protocol, at the time we were converting to CIDR, the point was to encourage network operators to move away from technology with known issues. However, the IETF recommends, in short, that network operators and residential customers may currently be using IPv4, and challenges to obtain an IPv6 prefix, turn on IPv6 routing between themselves and any peer and upstream or downstream neighbours, to enable it on their computers and use it in normal processing while having IPv4 stable becomes very difficult. The economic justification for running both becomes debatable, and the network until that point where IPv6... Anyway, it goes on and on and on, talks about it, and it's actually a nice, as you say, justification or rationalization as to why, and points out that really that NAT is, in the long term, is intended to provide a working solution until the critical mass of IPv6 exists, and give IPv4 a function over IPv6 and IPv6 over 4. And specifically says, at the point economic justification for running both becomes debatable, the network operators can justifiably turn IPv4 off. This process is comparable to RFC 4192 to to renumber a network using the same address family without a flag day. While running stably with the older systems, deploy the new, use the coexistence period to work out such kinks as they arise. When the new is also running stably, shift production to it. When network and economic conditions warrant, remove the old, which is now no longer necessary. So while it's pitched as a transition mechanism, one thing I know for sure today is that most people in the first world, Americas and Europe, aren't going to be doing anything. We've got enough IPv4 addresses. Carriers are going to deploy carrier grade now. And the vanguard of IPv6 deployment is most likely going to occur in Asia, notably China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Australia, because they have no more addresses in their NIC. And the APNIC is already into emergency delivery of IP addresses.
Yeah, they're into their last /8, which is about 2 months ahead of the most pessimistic schedule that I saw a few months ago.
I believe that you have to make a huge justification just to get a /22. So where before you could get a /16 or a /12. Which is a comment too. A couple of days ago, Microsoft took ownership of Nortel's original /12, paying $14 million for it. The point there is that if anybody wants to know, is it's not the fact that it was $14 an IP address, it was $7 million for a chunk. It's like buying real estate. You don't pay $8 a square inch for an acre of land. You pay $100,000 for an acre of land. Having 100,000 square inches doesn't make an acre of land if you don't own it all in one place. And that's exactly what Microsoft bought when they got their systems. And that was what's important to Microsoft, is to get enough IPv4 addresses for their cloudy thing or whatever it is that they wanted. $14 million was probably reasonably cheap, considering.
A lot of people are worried it's going to set a bad precedent for, you know, places like Afrinic, which are the last registrars that are going to run out of IP addresses for, you know, big companies to start going, guess what? We need some address space. What can you give us?
It's going to be interesting to see. There's already four companies on the internet who are buying and selling IP addresses.
Yeah. Well, at the summit, that was a big topic because, you know, all this does is puts a price tag on an IP address, right? So,
and it can only go up from here.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be $14 an IP address. Yep. If you rock up to me and say, I've got a /24, that's not, you know, for most companies, that's not worth, you know, big money. It's only worth a small amount. It's the /12. It's like an exponential curve. The bigger the address range, the larger it's going to be.
Yeah.
Now, I think if this, if the NAT64 stuff actually makes it into real production, I understand their lofty goals with it, but it is May 1st today. I promise you, I'll bet you $50 today that if this makes it into production, it will eventually persist long past the exhaustion of IPv4, because there'll just be lazy people out there that want to keep doing what they've always been doing, and they don't want to inconvenience their end users, and, oh, well, we'll just make it work good enough. And so there has to be an expiration date or a finite period where this is useful. And I don't see them doing that anytime soon, which is why I continue to think that this is just going to be a bad idea.
Yeah, I got to agree with you. And you know, it's funny, is, you know, like you said, with vendors, they're going to, any port in a storm, you know, they're going to sell you what a customer wants, anything that they can sell you through. But like, I'm looking at an advertisement for a vendor product. I won't say their name, but the actual ad says IPv6 migration, IPv4 preservation. So we'll sell you both. It's all right. Just tell us what you want.
Sounds like something you should be doing in a museum.
You've got to remember too that there are people out there who aren't receiving the necessary training and aren't being given time by their companies to take time out to learn IPv6 and add new technologies. You know, and they've got a 50-hour working week and they can barely keep up with the work that they want.
Yeah.
You know, if the boss turns up and says you've got to turn this service on next week, you're going to struggle to, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
but see, that hasn't really been the case though, right? Because how long have we known that we're going to be out of IPs? And, you know, people have known, and it wasn't until, I mean, look at how much people are talking about it now that they announced that IANA's got no more address space, right? Oh, so now it's huge, right? That's to me, in my mind, that's the equivalent of telling people there's going to be a tsunami. And you're like, okay, but it hasn't happened yet, so we'll just hang out here until it happens. And then we'll go.
Well, not exactly. A tsunami is in the valley. It's more like vaccination.
Well, yeah.
So, okay, so vaccination is, as long as everybody's vaccinated,
yeah,
then vaccination works. And it only needs vaccination only needs to drop below 96%, and the society is vulnerable.
Yeah.
So if just 4% of people don't inoculate their children against polio or, you know, whatever it is, then you'll end up with a situation where the whole community is vulnerable. So you have to have 100% coverage amongst, so everybody's got to join in. And the thing was, we just couldn't get everybody to join in on IPv6. And it's a long road to hoe.
Well, here's a point that I had heard that I hadn't really thought of it before, but convincing an organization to go to IPv6 is difficult to do when there's no ROI, right? What's the return for a business to move to IPv6? What are they going to get out of it? Nothing. It's just something they have to do, right?
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
Well, the only way you're going to get an ROI is if you get some kind of new killer product or killer application that can only be seen or reached over V6. You know, I could see, and this is a hypothetical, but I could see a huge driver for IPv6 if all of a sudden Facebook shut off their IPv4 connectivity for 2 or 3 days and said, the only way you'll be able to get to us is through V6 now. There would be riots outside of ISP buildings, people with pitchforks and torches saying, we want Facebook, we want Facebook. So it's going to have to be that kind of driver to really get people to wake up, because I don't think there's ever going to be a true... Yeah. You know, like a compelling ROI, like you're saying, Brandon. You're like, oh, yeah. Well, you know, if we go to V6, we're going to make, you know, 3% more year over year kind of thing.
Well, have a look at – there is a comparison here, and that's virtualization. One of the things about VMware is that VMware doesn't actually improve anything. Mm-hmm. All it does is take your existing servers that – you know, your data center that was kind of full and allows you to collapse it down to something slightly better. Or – the first phase of virtualization offers very limited benefits to most people today. Oh. And it's going to be interesting to see how that works out.
Yeah.
In the long run, people will see IPv6 for what it is, which is it's just something that we have to do. We're not going to get a choice around it.
Yep.
And like it or lump it, that's just the way it is.
It's one of those things. I mean, I could go on for days about IPv6 and just the after going to that summit, it just blows my mind how unprepared people are and how many misconceptions there are. And it's going to be fun times ahead.
It's a very deep well.
Yeah, I think we're going to have troubles finding out why and how and all that sort of stuff. It's, you know, we're just going to have to keep working through it until we find a reason for making it happen the way it is.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. You know, it's not like IPv6 will deliver benefits in the long run, but it's going to be more like Y2000. You're not going to do it because you have to, because you want to, or because there's a clear benefit. You're going to do it because you have to, and, you know, bite me if you don't like it. It's going to be a difficult one to sell, but at the end of the day, IT managers just going to say, like, it's like working at a company that's got end-of-life equipment sitting in its rack, you know, that they've still got PIXs. Companies out there still running PIX 535s with 7.2, you know, the last version of PIX code on it. And until that box goes end of support in 2013, they ain't going to replace it.
I think I've been to that company.
I probably work for it. And, you know, that's just a track of life. Those people aren't going to move over, and they were never going to move to IPv6 until that sort of event came around. And that's just where we are.
Yeah.
You know, being angry about it isn't going to solve anything. Just imagine, just think of all the work that we're going to do and how much of network overhaul. I mean, how much structural change have we actually made to networks in the last 20 years? Not much. The last significant investment in the networking infrastructure for companies was at the turn of the century when Y2K bug forced an investment. And since then, not much has changed. And the data center and the IPv6 migrations are driving all the change in networking today. Well, okay, guys, I think we'll wrap it up there. That's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'm travelling over to Interop next week, courtesy of Hewlett-Packard Networks, and I'll be probably recording a show or some content from there and catching up with a number of figures. I'm not 100% sure what my agenda's going to be, but if you're at Interop, come and find me. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us this week. Tom, what are you going to be doing this week?
Oh, this week I am probably going to be churning out a book review for IPv6 Enterprise Networks from Cisco Press. I just finished it up this weekend. And beyond that, I'm probably going to be trying to find ways to sabotage these new RFCs and hope they never come to the light of day. And if you want to join my crusade against NAT and all its unholiness, you can check me out at networkingnerd.net, or you can follow me on Twitter as @networkingnerd.
And Brandon, what are you going to be doing this week, and where can we find you?
I got a Friday deadline on some development, so I'm going to be knee-deep in PowerPoint and Word docs all week. So it should be fun, but I'll probably knock out a IPv6 blog post or something here. Maybe join in the fight against the NAT with Tom here. But you can find me at globalconfig.net or brandonjcarroll.com, and I'm on Twitter at @BrandonCarroll.
And I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me at etherealmind.com and on the Twitter as @etherealmind. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so email us packetpushers@gmail.com or get in contact via the podcast website if I can keep it up for long enough, because I'm struggling to keep the website working right now for whatever reason. As always, you can follow us on Twitter. And again, remember that please, if you can hit up a rating on iTunes so people can find us, or on StumbleUpon, for those of you who know what that is, and link to the packet pushers. As always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.